My name is Allison Levin. What I actually have studied is, and what my focus primarily is because I come from a slightly different background. My background is in economics and political science. I have a lot of communications experience, have studied communications, published in the communications era. I'm also an attorney. So I don't always look at baseball from the same way that everybody else does, but I was born and raised on baseball. My mother grew up as a diehard Yankees fan, living very, very close to Yankee Stadium, and I was born and bred and raised on Cardinal Nation and Cardinal baseball. So I've always looked at baseball, and I've always found a way to think about baseball in everything I've done, which has driven quite a few professors absolutely crazy as I turn a political science paper into a baseball paper, or an economics paper into a baseball paper, or a communications paper into a baseball paper. So what I'm going to present to you today on is what I called sabermetrics in practice, looking at All-Star games over 3 decades. And the reason I chose the All-Star game is the All-Star game is sort of the one place where we see all the best players together on the field at once. It's a really unique opportunity because the fans get, since 1970, have gotten to vote in the starting lineups, and it's a really unique experience. And for a lot of us, and any TV networks out there, I'm going to apologize for saying this, it's not about the ratings. It's not about, I don't care how many people tune in to Fox to watch the game or ESPN to watch the Home Run Derby. I tune in because I want those memories. There's so many unique things that happen in an All-Star game. Watching Mariano Rivera walk in to enter Sandman to a completely empty field and everybody standing up and cheering gave me chills at home. I can't even imagine what it was like for those players. Seeing Tony Gwynn in awe of Ted Williams when Ted Williams was on the field in Boston. Funny moments. John Kruk when he had to take his at-bat against Randy Johnson. It's those memories as sort of diehard fans that I live for. I tune in for the game, and I know it counts now, but I don't really care who wins, though. As a Cardinal fan, I will say, very, very, very happy we had home field advantage in 2011. Thank you, National League. But I don't care who wins. I don't even always stay to watch it. I want those moments, and that's what I thrive for. So what I was really interested in is how do we select? We're not just talking about the diehard fans voting. Anybody can vote. And now, really, anybody can vote. If you have an email address and a computer, you can vote every day, multiple times, if you have multiple email addresses. So I wanted to see, how do we vote? Why do we vote? So I was trying to understand what we value when choosing All-Stars. And what really the purpose of the study is to sort of look at the statistics and try to decide, you know, how do we do this? Because we know we have straight up lay people voting who are like, ooh, Derek Jeter's really cute, I'm voting for him. Or we have people who have, you know, a passing interest. I'm gonna vote for every single Cardinal player. Yeah, that's it. I'm gonna vote for my favorite 4 players. And then we have sort of the more diehard fans that if they take the time to vote, are probably sitting there with their statistics and their numbers and doing sort of analysis of, well, I kind of think Luke Roy's having a good season, but Yadi is Yadi, and you know, I gotta put him here, but what if I factor in Buster Posey? And so what do we really do? And this isn't necessarily like a full thought process, but it's how do our brains process and what do the statistics show? So what I looked at was 3 All-Star games. I looked at the 1994, 2004, and 2014 games. Those were selected, one, because it was 2014 when I was doing it, and figured 10 years. But it turns out also that there's a couple key things that are going on that made it interesting. And we're looking at the statistics for the 2 previous years, as well as the partial year statistics up to the All-Star game. And the reason I chose to do it that way was because there's some indication just from listening to media commentary that fans vote on previous years. You know, that sometimes you see players who just are having an awful year, or even on the disabled list, who suddenly make the starting lineup, and it's a lot to do with previous stuff. So, but what's interesting, it turns out, with these numbers, is they also mark some key points in All-Star game sort of voting history. In 2004, 50 million ballots were handed out in the stadiums, and that's where people voted. I firmly remember my brother and I collecting every All-Star ballot we could get our hands on, dragging them all home, and casting as many ballots as we could, and then dragging them all back to Busch Stadium and doing it again. Us and my father, the neat freak, setting us outside because of the little chads that were all over his living room floor, which drove him crazy. By 2004, Major League Baseball was encouraging us to start using the internet. So in 2004, they actually only distributed 10 million ballots in stadiums, and they were encouraging you for the first time to cast your ballot online. But the internet wasn't widespread yet. A lot of people didn't have access. So people did vote online, but it was only 40% of the ballots cast, and it represented 4.6 million ballots. So we saw a huge actual decrease in raw numbers of people who voted for the All-Star Game in that year. And then 2014, 90% of the ballots were cast online, which is expected. But what is amazing is those 90% constituted 52 million ballots. Think about it. In 1994, we handed out 50 million ballots in the stadium. That's how many were handed out, not voted. In 2014, 90% was represented by 52 million ballots. So we're seeing a huge change. And the question is do we see, can we explain it? What do we see in the terms of the trends? So I divided the statistics sort of into three general categories. And what we're looking at is, for me, I thought, well, we'll look at traditional statistics. And for those, and I can go into a lot more detail one-on-one, but a lot of stuff going on here. Sort of traditional statistics, the box score statistics, the stuff that are easy to get. Then I looked at visibility statistics. Those are things like market share, how many All-Star games have you played in, how many postseasons have you appeared in, you know, and did you make it to the wild card, NLDS, NLCS, World Series, you know, how many years have you played, what big awards have you won. The idea being behind all that is, how do people get on TV if you're not in a market? Market share has a huge part to do with it, but also former MVP winners, World Series people. A lot of people watch the World Series and nothing else. So how do we know about players? And then finally, I threw in some Saber statistics. And threw in is maybe not the right word. And I purposely did a couple different things, a couple different types of Saber variables. I focused on both general, what I'm calling, so ones that are like WAR, which are taking into all players, and then also position-specific values. So looking at, you know, catchers or other positional players. And then I also included, because I think it's important, and it might have something to do with having Starlin Castro on our fantasy team for a lot of years, I threw in some defensive statistics. Because in my mind, if you're going to cost me 5 runs making errors, I don't know if I really want you representing the National League in the All-Star game when there might be somebody who sure doesn't hit quite, might not have quite the same batting average, but, you know, is an amazing defensive player. So what ends up happening in this data set kind of threw me for a loop and got very confusing, is I had a lot of explanatory variables, a ton of independent variables, and the one dependent variable, which was specifically the percentage change in votes. And what I was looking at was the total votes between first and second place and second and third place at every single position across both leagues in all those years. And what I wanted to see was, how do we see that percentage change in votes in those positions change? So that's my dependent variable. But in terms of independent variables, they were large and numerous with a very small number of observations when I only looked at the top 3 vote getters at each position. So I got into a very confusing situation. And I'm going to readily admit that at this point I had to seek out numerous econometricians, mathematicians, statisticians, and I boggled many of their minds. And after much work, we came up with some ideas of how to best run these models. And I'm going to go over them briefly. I'm more than willing to talk about these one-on-one, but it's very detailed, and I have about 800 pages of SAS regressions. So if you want detailed information, I'm more than willing to talk about it one-on-one, but I'm going to give you sort of a broad overview. And what became clear, as I said, is you had to figure out first what model to use. But then, secondarily, there was a huge problem because every variable, to some extent, has a high correlation to every other variable because they're all sort of measuring similar things. So when does adding in an additional independent variable stop being meaningful at all? And then finally, what order do I need to enter the variables? Because they're all intercorrelated, which means that the first variable I enter is going to eat up the explanatory value, some of the explanatory value of the next variable, which will then eat up some of the explanatory value of the next variable. So whichever set of variables I put in first are automatically going to explain a larger percentage than if I put them in last. So it becomes very complicated, but very important of how do you do an order. And as I said, we had to do what ended up being a best fit model. And so I had SAS take every independent variable I had, and I said, and it's essentially based on Occam's razor. And I said, give me the one independent variable that has the most explanatory value. Now give me the two variables when together have the most explanatory value. Three variables, and so on. And the goal was to find the adjusted R squared that's maximized by the number of variables. And for those who aren't super familiar with statistics, what the adjusted R squared is looking at is for each independent variable I add in, does it add, first of all, is that variable significant? And then secondly, is the explanatory part of that variable greater than what would be expected by probability? So it's not just is the variable significant, but is its explanatory value more than just, hey, I rolled the dice and hey, it's, you know, probable. So I ran into a problem with that, which was because every single variable is correlated to some extent, every variable is going to add to, when I ran the initial results, every single variable was independent variable was statistically significant at the less than 1%, so a hugely significant. So every variable I added into adjusted R squared increased the value, which really doesn't usually happen. So I had to learn about a concept that's called overfitting, which is best explained by John Van Neumann. He gives this quote, which I think kind of makes it a little bit easier to understand. And he says, with four parameters, I can fit an elephant, and with five, I can make him wiggle his trunk. What we mean by that is at a certain point, adding in that next independent variable adds to the adjusted R squared, but doesn't really tell us anything meaningful. In his example, what was meaningful was explaining the elephant. Making the elephant wiggle his tail or wiggle his ears or lift up his foot, that's not as meaningful as actually describing how we get to the elephant. So I had to do the same thing with my data set. And so what I had to do was use a subset method before I even started running regressions to figure out what were the best variables to use. And what we were looking for is the best variables for each time period that maximized R squared, but were that had a great percentage and increase in R squared from the one less set of variables. So 9 variables had an R squared of 86%. 10 variables jumped that by 10%. When I added in the 11th variable, the explanatory value was maybe only 2%. So I looked for that point where the explanatory power of the variable stopped being quote unquote meaningful. It's important to note here a couple things. Every statistician will tell you there's no foolproof method to do this. You just have to sort of come up with a line and be standard. The second thing is because of what I'm doing, this model is never going to be predictive. But that was really not my goal. My goal was for this to be explanatory. So when we do this, we run through this quickly. 1994, I ended up using a 7-variable model. And that happened because we talked about, if you can see it, the 7-variable model explained a little over 10% more of the variance in percentage change in votes. But when I added in that next variable, the 8th variable, we saw very little increase in explanatory value. In 2004, I ended up using the 11-variable model. And it's for the same reason. The 10-variable model explained a fair amount, but the 11-variable model added in 10% explanatory value, whereas the next variable had very little explanatory value. And then for 2014, we ended up using a 12-variable model for similar reasons. Now, I'm going to pause here and say, you'll note the variables are different, and the number of variables are different. That's why we had to use a subset method to, because of the intercorrelation that is expected. And all of the statistical experts, the textbooks, the people who sold this, that is not important. The fact that the variables change is not important because of the intercorrelation coefficient, the coefficients of intercorrelation between the variables. To be safe, I ran every other test that was suggested to me for this model, and I received identical results no matter what type of test they did to pick the best model. So I feel confident in saying that these variables are the most explanatory for those periods. But what was really important, as I've said, is, and this sort of became almost the crux of the study, and I didn't expect it to be, is the sequential order. Is because what I talked about is in each set of best fit variables, there were some traditional, there were some sabermetric, and there were some visibility. And the order that I entered them into the final regression turned out to have a huge impact on the explanatory value because everything is, as I said, so intercorrelated. So, again, had to consult my experts because I'd never really run across this. And I was told you have to have an a priori method to determine the order in which to put in the variables. And so I crowdsourced, talked to fans, talked to non-fans, and the goal was to figure out, how do you become a baseball fan? What makes you become a baseball fan, and what makes you become a fan of one player or two players, a fan of a team, a fan of a league, or like those of us in the room, a diehard fan who studies everything they can get their hands on about baseball? What happens? Why is that there? And so this started off just about being, how do I sequence the variables? And turned out to be very explanatory even when we look at the results. So in asking around, and if you think about it for yourself, most people have absolutely no idea how they became a fan of baseball. For most of us, it's an initial memory. We have that one memory of like a player or game or something that's sort of like, that's our first baseball memory. For me, it's sitting on the floor of my parents' living room with Joe Buck on the radio, Cardinals 1982 World Series on. I don't remember really much about that series. I know we won. I know I know celebration. But most of what I know about that series, I learned after. That's the only memory I have, is sitting on that carpet with Jack Buck, and the TV. But I knew I was a baseball fan. And it's, when talking to people, we develop interests for a lot of different reasons. For some people, it's simply their parents encourage them. That little kid in that Albert Pujols jersey, I guarantee you, has no idea why his mom or dad has put him in an Albert Pujols jersey and set him on top of this weird ball and said, smile. But he's being told, he's a Cardinal fan because his parents are Cardinal fans. Or he's a Pujols fan because his parents are Pujols fans. Some it's broader. Some it's their favorite celebrity starts hanging out with a baseball player. For some, like me, it's just a player that every time you see him on TV, he's like doing something really cool. And as a little kid, you're like, holy cow, that's awesome. But what's clear is that once we get sort of general information, we want to learn more. We might just want to learn more about that player. We might want to learn more about the teams. And that's where we have to then look to visibility. Because we have to, how do we get the information? How easily is it accessible? For some of us, we will go as deep as we can. We will look as hard as we can to find information. For others, it's about how easy is it to get the information. And so that's visibility. And for visibility, some interesting facts that will play into the results is in 1994, the first period we looked at, 42% of Americans had pay television, and of those, about 8.1% were paying for premium services. So most people were not getting any sports through their cable. They were getting it on local TV. And approximately 32 games a year were shown on local TV. And just because I barely remember this, ESPN showed only three games a week. So we were not getting a lot of access to baseball just through network television. By 2004, 78% of Americans had cable television or pay television, and of those, 58% were paying for a package that includes sports. In addition, most people had access to 85% of their local market games. So we're starting to see a pretty significant increase in people who had access to baseball on television. 2014, 97% of Americans have some form of paid television. Maybe cable, maybe satellite, they may have cut the cord, maybe paying for the MLB app, MLB TV, you know, watching it on tablets, something, but there's access and 90% of Americans have it. Whoops. So then finally, the thought process was that then diehard fans want more information and more information and more information, and you seek it out because we want to understand. We don't just want to see the data. We want to understand what's going on in the field. So they start thinking about the various players and, you know, all the studies we've seen here this week. Why does player X strike out more than player Y? Why is Yadier Molina considered an excellent defensive catcher? What makes him special compared to other catchers? Why is David Ortiz an amazing hitter who will probably play to at least 60 and still be an amazing hitter? We try to understand that, and that's sort of the last step. So I had a couple hypotheses. Hypothesis one was that when information about players was limited, fans tended to vote on visibility and popularity. So they voted on what they saw. This was actually only partially supported, and I was a little bit surprised, but I think the folks from Sabre might be happy to see this result. When we look at the explanatory value of the variables, we see that in both 1994 and 2004, people intuitively were voting on what I called the Sabre variables. They turned out to be explanatory. In 1994, 43% of the All-Star Game voters, the Sabre variables explained their voting processes. And in 2004, 53% of the Sabre variables were explanatory. Now, one thing to note here is when I did my sequencing, Sabre was last because it made intuitive sense. Sabre was also last because I wanted to make sure that I gave you the most conservative estimate of the explanatory value of sabermetrics and all-star voting. So by putting it last, given the intercorrelation of the variables, this is the most conservative estimate. If I put it anywhere else in the order, that number would increase and does increase. Some interesting things is one, traditional variables and visibility are very highly correlated. And you can argue, and we did argue, about whether visibility comes first or traditional statistics come first. They're that intercorrelated. So we see that in 1994, we have those variables explaining, about 57, I think it is. Yes, 57, good memory. 57% of the explanatory power, and some of that is expected, you know, from what we talked about. 2004 becomes a little more interesting. You'll notice that zero for visibility. What happened was, is when I ran the best fit model, zero visibility variables showed up. Some of that is, I think, because of what we talked about just moments ago on the reasons why the TV saturation. Is the information was fairly equally available at that point, because if you were a baseball fan, you were probably part of the people paying for TV or watching your local games on TV. So the information was limited, but equally available. And so it was what you did with that information and whether you wanted to go seek out more information, whether you were me sitting on the floor with the USA Today and every box score, or whether you were just happy to watch, SportsCenter and get the little snippets. How much information do we want to seek out? My second hypothesis was that when fans had access to multiple games and nearly unlimited information about players on the web, fans tended to vote by comparing players. Now, I really thought this is where we were going to see Sabre come into the game. Obviously, from the previous two, we know I'm already wrong. In 2014, which is what I looked at, became very interesting. The Sabre value actually decreased a little bit, and we saw a bigger increase in traditional the explanatory value of traditional variables and visibility. And this is where I said, you know, how we become baseball fans once again becomes important. Because there's a couple things going on here, and the coefficients of these statistics, I'm not going to go into great detail on here. When I write it up, I will, are a little wonky. For lack of a better word, the some are negative when you'd expect them to be positive and have been positive in every other year, and vice versa. And so there's a couple of things going on. Number one is what I said. Everybody can vote. All you need is an email address. We saw a large percentage increase in voters from international countries voting for the All-Star Game, which is probably a large part of that visibility, because we saw, too, in 2014, 43% of the first and second place vote-getters were from countries that were not the United States or had affiliations with countries that were not the United States. So we started to see, in a quick look at the Twitter numbers when we get to, and looking at content of Twitter, is we started to see Latin players talking, you know, trying to solicit votes from their hometown communities. We saw, you know, people from the Dominican voting for Dominican players. And so we started to see sort of that international. It's also important to note here that MLB TV has an international package. And local areas that don't have the wealth to afford those packages also tape delay and show games with some of their hometown heroes on their local TV. The second thing, and I'm going to go into literally no detail on this because there are plenty of people in the room who can explain this a lot better than me, but I have to believe fantasy baseball plays a role, is the layperson is now playing fantasy baseball, and they're rooting for their team, and they believe their players are awesome, or they believe other players are awesome, and that becomes kind of a pretty big deal, and so that is definitely impacting the numbers. And then finally, and I'm running out of time, and I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, but more than I want to talk about is information overload. We live in a 24/7 news cycle. Yesterday afternoon, when the Texas Rangers formally announced that Yu Darvish was going to have Tommy John surgery, a quick survey of just my Twitter feed, now remember, I study social media, within 15 minutes of that announcement, 65 different sources tweeted out that information. We are getting more information than we've ever had, and we don't have norms yet on how to report that. It's so many media outlets looking, so many teams looking for click-throughs, looking for people to select their information. And so we are starting to see an era where we're going to have to come up with norms. We're going to have to come up with stuff. Is we're having information breaches happening nearly continually. We had the stuff with Matt Kemp and his San Diego physical becoming public. We had all the stuff going on with Josh Hamilton currently with private information no longer being private. The average fan and even the diehard fan is getting information that they don't know how to process. I may know what it means when a pitcher doesn't pitch every game in the preseason. I may know what it means when a pitcher goes into a slump. All this research that we've been hearing helps us understand that, but the average fan may not realize that somebody who has a 20-game hitting streak isn't necessarily an all-star, and we have to learn how to make sense of that. Really quickly, and I'm sorry that I'm running out of time a little bit, it's just hypothesis three was that Twitter would make an impact. And this is really the bulk of my research. This is what I'm working on, and this is where the future research is needed. I looked at tweets and retweets for the 2014 year. We considered a tweet a call for action, and the retweet, hey, I did it, thank you. And what I saw was a significant increase, statistically significant, for two places. The first place vote getters received the most, percentage explanatory value, the percentage change in all-star votes for first place vote getters based on retweets was the biggest. So the first place vote getters, the retweets had some impact on the percentage change. And most interestingly for me is that third place number where we see that those retweets for third place was, and this is the average for each play, each observation. The average player in third place got 13,258 retweets. And what's interesting to note is that in 1994, less than 2% of all-star players in the top three were represented by TV small market teams. In 2014, it was over 10%, and the majority of those were in third place. So as we start talking about this, we see that we're getting more efficient with using tweets. So we see the tweets stay the same, but the retweets are going up. And that has a lot to do with other research I've done, which I'm more than happy to talk to you about after the presentation. But just to sort of wrap this up, is where we are and where we're going is we need to start understanding how to use social media, how social media impacts us, because we see the numbers and the variables showed a statistically significant increase of votes, percentage change of votes based on Twitter. And that was just team tweets. Twitter is changing the way that we think about things. Twitter is giving us information, and it's going to become important for media, baseball teams, organizations, Major League Baseball, Sabre, everybody, to start using Twitter wisely to educate and be the one that gets those retweets. Because right now, I can tell you from previous research, nobody can tell you why somebody retweets a particular tweet, why somebody chooses to use a particular hashtag, why something goes viral. Those are things we just don't know. And that's the goal of my research, is I've got three projects going on, which all, hopefully, by this time next year, at least in terms of baseball, I'll be able to tell you what characteristics make somebody retweet a baseball statistic, what causes that to happen. And that's where my research is going, and I think that that is the final piece for all of this information that we're gathering, is how do we disseminate it, how do we use it, and that's what every single one of the professional panelists were talking about, is how do we use that, and I think my research is going to add to that. And I am being approached, and I know I am out of time. If there's any quick questions, I can probably answer one. If not, I'm more than willing to talk to people. I really look at Twitter, coaching changes, leadership, crisis communication, retweets, tweets, trends. So any questions about that outside this research, more than willing to talk to you. But are there any quick questions? Nope. Okay. Awesome. Thank you.